Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And this is The Exchange. Tough talk on immigration by the Trump administration, concerns about Dreamer deportation, and a court-blocked executive order on federal funding have placed intense scrutiny on the sanctuary city movement. In New Hampshire and around the country, communities large and small are grappling with uncertainty over how municipal governments, religious institutions, and local law enforcement should respond to federal demands for greater cooperation in the handling of undocumented immigrants. The conflict has raised a host of legal issues about states' rights, federal jurisdiction, and the potential for civil disobedience in response to stepped-up federal enforcement of immigration laws. We'll look at the controversy surrounding undocumented immigrants, the sanctuary city movement, and the Trump administration's push for more local cooperation on deportation. Today on The Exchange, it's uncertainty over undocumented immigrants. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have four guests joining me for the show this morning. With me in studio is Erin Corcoran. She's a professor of law at the University of New Hampshire Law School with a focus on immigration law. And Erin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. for the first part of the program is Maria Sacchetti. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering immigration, and she previously worked at the Boston Globe. And Maria, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by NHPR's Emily Corwin and WBR Boston's Shannon Dooling, who are both part of the New England News Collaborative. I want to start with some legal and definitional issues. So let me turn to you first, Erin, and then we'll talk about national political context with Maria. What does it mean to be a sanctuary city or community?
Sure. So it basically means that the community has decided that they don't want local law enforcement inquiring about a person's immigration status as a matter of course. And so they will usually pass ordinances or policies that prohibit local law enforcement from asking someone's immigration status if they're stopping them for some other reason or interacting with them for some other reason.
How does one become how does a community, a state, an organization become a sanctuary city? Is it just sort of there are different rules for different localities, or who decides?
Sure. I mean, generally speaking, law enforcement is typically a local issue, and the procedures that govern local law enforcement are governed by the municipality or county in which they reside. States also have a state law enforcement as well, and so they can pass state policies. It can be done through ordinances at a municipal level, legislation at a state level, or it can also be guidance or policy directives coming out of the executive branch.
But there's not a federal definition of a sanctuary city. Congress has not legislated some sort of a definition.
Not at this point. There's been attempts in the past to do so, but have they been unsuccessful?
Do you think this might happen in the future? You think the Trump administration might try to codify this as a means of kind of tightening enforcement?
I mean, I think there's definitely would be an opportunity for that to happen. We've seen efforts in the past with Congress in attempts to basically outlaw sanctuary cities through federal legislation.
Mm-hmm. Maria, let me turn to you. You cover immigration for The Washington Post. Let me just ask you a very broad initial question about what it means to be here illegally. There are a number of different ways that we think about the issue of illegal immigration, and I'm interested to hear your sort of general thoughts of the kinds of issues that you report on.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to fall out of immigration status.
Right.
A lot of the people who are now here illegally initially came to America legally. They were vetted. They obtained visas, maybe tourist visas. student visas, all kinds of other visas, and they did not leave when they were supposed to. Other people across the border, which of course, you know, that's you're entering, you're not vetted, you're coming across, they say, without inspection. But that's also, you know, that's an illegal act, but it's also a deadly, it can be deadly. I mean, there's lots of people who die crossing the border. It's a big risk to take.
Right. I've heard some in this debate say that the issue of overstaying visas is actually a bigger issue than crossing the border illegally. Do you have any numbers on that, you know, numbers of sort of overstaying visas versus, you know, other types of illegal entry?
I don't know that it's. I don't have them at hand, but
sure.
But I don't know that it's more. And I'm not sure anyone can say for sure because it's an undocumented population. And during the 90s, you know, the number of apprehensions at the border were really high, and of course now they've trickled down to very few. Still in the thousands, but nothing compared to what it was. But yeah, I mean, definitely visa overstayers are a big chunk of the people here illegally.
Sure. And I'm curious, you know, we've heard a lot of reporting over the first few months of the Trump administration that illegal border crossings are down dramatically. I recall that President Obama had also stepped up deportations as well. Do you think that the decrease that we're seeing now is a function of kind of Trump rhetoric or stepped up enforcement? Is there a noticeable difference?
You mean the decline in the number of people crossing the border?
Yes, we've heard a lot about how it's been down, and the Trump administration has been claiming it's because of their policies and their tough talk.
I think people, a lot of people are saying probably that's having an effect. I mean, you know, people, especially if you're seeking asylum, and you don't want to be in jail for a significant amount of time. A lot of people are fleeing dangerous conditions, and you know, they might perhaps be seeking asylum elsewhere. And you know, and it affects smugglers. You know, I mean, some folks were saying that during the Obama administration, smugglers would tell immigrants, you know, would-be immigrants in Central America that they had a chance, you know, to seek asylum or to stay in the United States. And people would pay thousands of dollars or take out loans in order to cross. Certainly,
you mentioned asylum seekers. How does that fit into to your reporting?
Well, I think it's been published, you know, and the State Department has acknowledged in its own reports that Honduras and El Salvador are some of the two of the nations with some of the highest homicide rates in the world, and so a lot of people fleeing those countries are fleeing for their lives, and say they are fleeing for their lives, so they're seeking asylum, but it's a very high bar. So some people are also coming for a better life and to seek jobs, but that's not a reason to receive asylum. So each person has to, you know, prove their case.
We're talking about immigration, undocumented immigrants, sanctuary cities today on The Exchange. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm talking with Erin Corcoran of the University of New Hampshire School of Law and Maria Sacchetti of The Washington Post. And Erin, let me turn back to you and let's focus for a moment more specifically again on sanctuary cities or communities, and just give our listeners a sense of what is the crux of the legal controversy in terms of local cooperation with federal authorities. What are the kind of the big issues that have given this such increasing prominence in the news?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing to consider is that sort of what does local law enforcement think their role is in the community? And for many, what has been shown to and has been based in evidence is that police officers and law enforcement that have a relationship with their community are better able to serve their community, better able to investigate crimes. People are willing to come forward if they've been victimized because they have a trust in law enforcement. This is sort of the community policing model that we talk a lot about, and we know that it works. And so one of the concerns about communities that have significant numbers of people that are out of status is whether or not they would be willing to come forward if they were the victims of crime or had witnessed a crime. And in fact, we saw when the human trafficking federal legislation was passed, there was actually immigration relief provided to non-citizens if they were willing to come forward. And this was at the behest of law enforcement because they were having challenges with people coming forward and reporting crime. So communities that take on sanctuary city policies want their law enforcement to be in the business of stopping, preventing, and helping prosecute crimes. They don't see their role as one of immigration enforcement. That's a federal function.
And we often hear about, or increasingly are hearing a mention of the 10th Amendment and the reserve powers of the states. Talk a little bit about kind of the joint federal state nature of the relationship.
Sure. So there's certain things in the Constitution that are enumerated that the federal government has the powers to regulate and legislate upon. And immigration has historically been seen by the courts as one such function. All other things that are not specified or enumerated in the Constitution are left up to the states to decide. So we things like education, property tax, law enforcement, those are things that are left up to the states. And the idea is that we want states and localities to be incubators of innovation. We want them to be responsive to the needs specific to the communities which reside there. And so we want them to make their own policies. And so to the extent the federal government seeks to try and influence that policies, mm-hmm. there's restrictions on that. Mm-hmm. So take, for example, in New Hampshire, we don't have a mandatory seatbelt law for people who are over 18,
right.
Even though the federal government for years has been pushing states to enact legislation and even sweeten it by providing federal funding through
right.
the spending clause. But the federal government cannot make New Hampshire do that. So that's sort of the argument with law enforcement. There's limits to what kind of conduct federal governments can require of local law enforcement in enforcing immigration mm-hmm. laws, which are federal statutes.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, let's talk for a moment a bit more about what's going on politically nationally with regard to sanctuary cities and immigration. We saw a number of May Day rallies on Saturday that were focused yeah. on immigration and kind of had a theme focusing on sanctuary cities and stepped up deportations. I'm interested to kind of get your sense of sort of the national sanctuary movement and where you think it is headed and kind of where the energy is right now.
Well, I mean, if you look at a map, you know, you can see that most cities and towns don't seem to be doing anything about it. But you can also see this polarization with big cities definitely are standing by their sanctuary city policies, where some places like, you know, looks like, you know, some places are divided. Mississippi essentially outlawed sanctuaries, but apparently they don't have one. And it's interesting that according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, there are like 32 states, and the bills are divided within those states. You know, some people really feel strongly that law enforcement should work together, and that immigration is part of that. And immigration, you know, they have different roles. I mean, they have a unit that investigates sex offenders, that helps deal with human trafficking. But they also have this other, you know, big section that cracks down on, you know, undocumented immigrants, and who, you know, some people feel, you know, compete with Americans for jobs. And apparently research shows that they do at the low, particularly the low wage level, but not at all jobs. And farmers will tell you they desperately need immigrant labor. And they're certainly finding work in the service industries and other industries nationwide. So I guess that is to say that it's not clear. I think the Trump administration introduced a lot of uncertainty, you know, for government officials, you know, who would like to be sanctuaries but aren't always sure what to do. But certainly advocates, you know, people who are very concerned about the safety of immigrants are definitely mobilized more than I've seen them in years.
And I'm just curious a little bit about the history of the sanctuary city movement. Is this something that's been around for a while? I mean, obviously the Trump administration has brought it to the forefront politically, but this is not a new phenomenon, correct?
Right. So it stems from the 1980s, the war in the wars in Central America, but in particularly Salvadorans. I know Cambridge, Massachusetts was one of the first, San Francisco also, and it was largely at first, a church-based movement, right? So you see a lot of immigrants today seeking sanctuaries in churches.
Churches, right.
But also governments were involved, and they declared their areas sanctuaries. And like now, you know, each decision was different and singular in many ways, right? So there's a lot of similarities among the government sanctuary policies today, but there are also important differences. You know, if you look at the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, their sanctuary city policy is actually they actually show a certain willingness to work with ICE that you don't see in Boston's policy or Lawrence's policy as much. Another kind of confusing thing with the sanctuary city policies is that they often say that ICE, you know, they'll honor an immigration warrant if it's for a crime, but what ICE, and that's possible, you know, if ICE wants to arrest someone for a crime, but for the most part, the ICE is looking to arrest people who for civil immigration violations, and that's, you know, that you won't have a criminal warrant for that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I know we only have you for a few more minutes, Maria, so let me come back to you. I'm just interested in getting a sense of the difficulties you've encountered, if any, in reporting on immigration. Sort of what are the kind of the big challenges you face in trying to cover the story from a national perspective?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people are paying closer attention now. So, and that's, you know, as a reporter who writes these stories, it's great. But I think there's also a lot of confusion about what's new and what isn't, and also our role. You know, there's a lot of people who are, you know, comparing President Trump to Obama, and so are we. You know, we want to see how the numbers are changing from year to year. But I think our role as journalists, we certainly should look back, but I think we also have to pay very close attention to what this administration is doing and to try to document it as best as possible.
Does this feel like a big, you mentioned President Obama, does the current administration feel like a big change to you? Or, you know, we had heard that President Obama was actually focused on stepping up deportations as well. So what kind of changes have we seen?
Right, and there is just no question that President Obama deported a lot of people, and it really depends on your perspective, right? So for some people, he didn't deport enough, right? I mean, I think at the end of the day, it was maybe 4% of the total number of illegal immigrants in the country, right? But the people who were deported, and a lot of those folks were not criminals, right? So they're just people who came here to work and lived here a long time. A lot of those, that really ripped apart families across the country, and people felt that was contradictory to what he said, you know, President Obama said he wanted to do. And it was, right? He said felons, not families. He said he didn't want to deport and, you know, to separate families, but his administration did that. The difference, though, is that Trump has unapologetically said that everybody is subject to deportation, including those folks who were not criminals, where Obama advocates feel really tried throughout his, you know, from day one, let's say, he really did try to pass a bill that would grant citizenship to people, and he created things like DACA and tried to do DAPA for parents of American citizens and legal residents that would have given them some relief from deportation. But Trump, that's not happening at that we can see very much at all.
Well, Maria, I know we have to let you go, but we really appreciate you taking out some time for your day to tell us about your national reporting on immigration. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Maria Sacchetti. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering immigration. She previously worked for the Boston Globe. We need to take a short break, but coming up, we'll talk with New Hampshire and Massachusetts reporters who have been covering the immigration debate and undocumented immigrants more locally. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello. On the latest episode of The Bookshelf from NHPR, author Benjamin Ludwig talks about his novel, Ginny Moon, a young girl with autism who has trouble speaking up for herself.
children in general have an uphill battle learning how to speak up for themselves, learning how to speak at all sometimes. And I really did want to give a voice to someone who otherwise would have remained largely voiceless.
Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, we're talking uncertainty over undocumented immigrants. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can respond to us on Facebook or Twitter or at NHPR Exchange. Still with me for the hour is Erin Corcoran of University of New Hampshire Law School. But now joining me also is Emily Corwin. Emily is a New Hampshire public radio reporter covering news in southern New Hampshire and the state's criminal justice system. She's also one of eight reporters with the New England News Collaborative, which includes public media newsrooms across New England. Emily, it's good to see you.
Hi.
And also joining us on the phone now is Shannon Dooley. And Shannon, who is also part of the New England News Collaborative, is a reporter at WBUR Boston. Her beat includes immigration and related topics. And Shannon, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you.
Erin, let me go back to you. We heard Maria talk about the national context at length, talking a little bit about some of the challenges of covering it, the differences between Obama and Trump. Let me get your reactions broadly to her comments.
Sure. Thank you. I mean, I think there is a difference between sort of what the Trump administration is currently doing, both in messaging and on the ground, than what the Obama administration did. It's clear that the Obama administration did prioritize deportation and really did step up the number of people that were being deported. However, the administration had a pretty detailed set of priorities on sort of who they wanted to target. And that was, and that's not to say that there weren't people, families that were torn apart, as Maria mentioned, but it was clear that they had finite resources and they wanted to use those resources to prioritize deporting people who had serious criminal convictions and were seen as a danger to the country. I think with the rhetoric as well as the executive orders that this new administration has issued, what we're seeing is that there is not so much a prioritization of different classes of people who don't have status in the United States, but that sort of anyone is going to be subject to deportation.
So the uncertainty here is simply that Trump has said everybody's subject to deportation, and people are now trying to kind of read the tea leaves about sort of, you know, who really is at risk. We don't really know.
Right. So, for example, under the Obama administration, there was a memo that was called the Secured Communities Memo, which basically said there were certain locations that were off limits to Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE. While the Trump administration has said that memo is still in effect, and those locations included hospitals, schools, and churches, there have been anecdotal reports that ICE officers are going to those places. And so that, again, creates uncertainty about sort of are there any safe places or sanctuaries for people who don't have status in the United States.
And let me bring Emily and Shannon into the conversation. Now, Emily, let me get your take on kind of northern New England. You're covering this topic. What are sort of the kind of key aspects of this that you see coming up time and again, New Hampshire, Vermont, northern New England?
Sure. So New Hampshire doesn't have sanctuary cities. Vermont has a couple locations. But what I've been covering includes the way that police enforce or do not collaborate with ICE. Mm-hmm. And in that context, there's just so much variation. There's variation between how the local police in New Hampshire do or do not ask people's immigration status, do or do not contact ICE when they have some suspicion someone may not have papers. For example, like Salem Pelham, they do call ICE. They do search a database for anybody they have a suspicion about, which immediately pings ICE, lets them know. Nashua does not, as a rule. Nobody is allowed to ask immigration status unless it is absolutely necessary for an investigation, something like that. Now, at the state level, in Vermont, there are a number of state laws and rules in place to prevent any law enforcement in Vermont from basically acting in any capacity as the deputies of ICE. They aren't to use any state resources. They aren't to contact ICE, I believe, unless it's necessary for an investigation. in New Hampshire, it's completely different. In New Hampshire, there is no policy, no training in place for state troopers in terms of how to deal with people whose immigration status may be unclear. There's, unlike Vermont, there's no guidance as to whether or not you can ask people their immigration status. And I can talk more later about all of the different anecdotes I've heard talking to people who have watched people in their own vehicles get detained or who have basically been subject to the collaboration between mm-hmm. state troopers and ICE.
And Shannon, we've been talking so far this hour about really the crux of the uncertainty is this issue of tremendous variation from locality to locality, combined with the Trump administration saying everybody's at risk, and then we're all trying to figure out who exactly is at the greatest risk of deportation. What are you seeing down in Massachusetts and that part of New England?
Right. So it's interesting, to Aaron's point earlier, the head of the ACLU Massachusetts, Carol Rose, had said that essentially it's in her words, it's open season on immigrants who are undocumented living in the U.S. So to reiterate, it's not so much that there are new priorities, but that everyone is a priority. And so that, establishes a certain level of fear and uncertainty among immigrant communities. And so here in Massachusetts, we do have a number of so-called sanctuary cities, and I do preface it with so-called because there really is no legal definition,
right,
to confirm that. And so we do have, Boston, a so-called, passed the Trust Act. We have the same sort of policies set in place in Somerville and Lawrence and Chelsea. And so in those communities, there are, policies on the books that prohibit or limit the amount of cooperation that local law enforcement can really offer to federal immigration officers. But we do have, a few communities such as Springfield, a big city in central western Mass, actually, and Hull down near the Cape. They both have come out and said, we are not going to put these sanctuary city policies on the books for various reasons. And so we are definitely seeing a trend in Massachusetts of the conversation happening. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting to me that cities and communities are, putting this unofficial title to a vote, right? And we've got Newton, Massachusetts, that just recently, maybe 2 months ago, passed a welcoming city ordinance. And so they're taking this up and putting it to the communities and to the city councils. Of course, Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state,
right,
so to speak. Governor Charlie Baker has said that he supports that decision happening at the local community, at the local level. But he has not come out and said, had any support really for the Safe Communities Act that's, in front of the Massachusetts legislature right now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of all over the board.
And for some, for our listeners, from the reading I've done, I keep coming across figures anywhere from 40 to 60 cities that officially consider themselves sanctuary cities, just to give you a sense of the scope. But Shannon, I've also read that places like Providence, Rhode Island, and Portland, Maine, have kind of avoided that tag, yet they essentially have policies on the ground that serve essentially the same purpose. Do you see that?
The
underlying
that's right.
kind of legal context.
Right. And I mean, if you ask, I sat down with the chief of police in Chelsea, Brian Kies, and if you ask him, they're not in any way, violating the sort of constitutional, questions at hand in terms of cooperating with ICE officials. He'll tell you, and perhaps I'm not all that familiar with Portland and Providence, Rhode Island, but I'm willing to bet that he'll tell you we're not in violation of any of these policies. We simply don't have the information that ICE might request of us because we don't ask immigration status. We don't know.
Right.
It's not that we're withholding information or refusing to cooperate. We just don't have the information that ICE might be asking because we are a city that does not ask someone's immigration status mm-hmm. when, say, they get pulled over for, having a taillight out or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have Ken joining us from Antrim. Ken, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. Let's say a man brings his wife and 2-year-old boy over illegally. country. They're here, 20-plus years. They're all living a good life. This kid's gone to the local high school. I'll pay taxes for him to go to the school. He graduates. He has a good job. His parents committed a crime and breaking into our country, obviously. But a three-year-old boy, how can they keep me charged in any way in our court system for an action that his parents took upon his behalf?
Yeah, Ken, we're having a little bit of trouble hearing you. I think the connection sounds like perhaps a cell phone. Let me turn to you, Aaron. He raised the issue of parents bringing their children into the United States, and we've heard a lot about the Dreamers and the Obama's DACA program. How does that fit into the sort of larger issue of the Obama Trump administration policy?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the concern that the caller just mentioned on the phone is one that I think policymakers have had for quite a long time, and that is, what do we do with children who don't make a choice in deciding whether to come to the United States and come here and have a right to go to school and are upstanding members of their community? What happens to them? And there was many attempts in Congress, and in fact, it even passed in the Senate at one point, to create a pathway of legalization for these children. It was referred to as the DREAM Act, bipartisan support, sponsored at one point by Orrin Hatch from Utah. Unfortunately, that legislation never became law, but under the Obama administration, he used his executive branch authority, prosecutorial discretion, to create the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which allows these children to remain here in the United States as if they register with immigration. They have to show they don't have any criminal convictions and have good moral character and came here as a child. And it allows them to remain here temporarily and potentially get work authorization. Under the executive orders that have been issued by the Trump administration, that particular policy has not been rescinded. Mm-hmm. And it remains to see what's going to happen with it. It was promulgated as an executive order by President Obama. So in order to get rid of it, it needs to be taken away by Congress, the courts, right, or the executive branch. President Trump has not done that yet. But again, we did see recently a young man who did have DACA status, who was caught up in a enforcement activity by ICE and was actually sent back to Mexico, because deferred action for childhood arrivals is just a priority, not to deport. It's not.
Now, is this the case where the ICE claimed that they arrested him coming back into the country, that he had gone out and come back?
Or, right. This is
there was some conflict over the competing stories of what actually happened.
And it's being litigated in the courts right now, but he has been returned to his country of birth.
Yeah. Emily, I'm interested in your thoughts on this sort of larger issue here of the Dreamers and families, et cetera.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just at the May Day rally in Manchester on the 1st, and one thing that I heard being talked about is all of the kids who either are citizens or aren't being deported and trying, you know, there was an immigration attorney who spoke there, and her message to the crowd was like, if there is any chance that you are going to be swept up by ICE, have a plan. She said that many times. And I know that there are groups in New Hampshire who, for example, I think Father Gerdak, who is a Catholic priest in a parish in Manchester that serves largely Hispanic members. I believe it's he who is asking, you know, congregants who fear they may be deported to give him, and he has collected these, a list of their finances and a plan, desires for what should happen with their children. And basically the church is taking on the role of, you know, helping to manage children who are left behind. And I'm trying to remember what exactly the context is around this number, but I know that many senators in this country recently submitted a letter to Homeland Security asking for guidance as to what to do with children left behind. And the number that I remember from this letter was 5,100 kids who have been left, whose parents have been deported, who have been left here. And I don't know that's, you know, over how much time. But it's a lot of kids to think about, you know, basically being orphaned by ICE.
Mm-hmm. And Shannon, let me bring you in here. How is the issue playing in Massachusetts?
Well, to Emily's point, we do have conversations around sanctuary churches, sanctuary synagogues, and support at the level of the faith communities here in terms of, you know, the congregants really stepping up and saying, this is a safe place for you. And so they are, you know, trying to offer support in that fashion. I think one thing that strikes me in sort of just listening to the conversation as a whole is, you know, the element of just individual determination at the ICE level in terms of the discretion that ICE agents have and the decision-making process that goes on in any sort of situation. So it's astounding to me, and it's kind of like the broader topic of immigration law in general. I mean, it's so much is up for interpretation in terms of the level and the extent of which ICE, you know, has the authority to do their job. And it brings me back to a conversation I had with a retired ICE agent who basically said he had complete discretion when he walked into a room. If he had a so-called target, if you will, someone that he was, you know, supposed to be bringing in for questioning or to start the deportation process, you know, he could go into a room and look at any number of people sitting in the room, and if he wanted to ask them about their status, he had the ability to do that. And he said, you know, he would be with other agents who would take that on, who would say, okay, I'm going to ask this person their status, the child, what's their status? And then other ICE agents would walk into the same room and just kind of take that person that was on their list. And I think that speaks to the broader sort of confusion and chaos and uncertainty and fear that we're living in right now in terms of the immigration policies in the country.
We're talking immigration policy, undocumented immigrants, sanctuary cities today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. I have three guests for the remainder of the hour. Emily Corwin, NHPR reporter and a member of the New England News Collaborative. Shannon Dooling is a WBUR reporter, also a member of the New England News Collaborative. And Erin Corcoran, professor of law at University of New Hampshire School of Law. And we had an email from Mary in Harrisville. We mentioned earlier in the show that there aren't any sanctuary cities in New Hampshire, so Manchester, Nashua, Concord, Portsmouth, not sanctuary cities. But Mary points out there are some towns that are sanctuary towns, Harrisville, for example, I think Lyme perhaps as well. So the movement clearly is kind of percolating, as we've suggested, at the level of small town, churches, other kinds of institutions. And let me turn to you, Erin. And I want to make sure we touch on this controversy over the Trump executive order that was blocked by district court judge in San Francisco. And Donald Trump used that as an opportunity to go after the Ninth Circuit, even though it hadn't actually been appealed yet, the Circuit Court of Appeals. Just give us a little bit of clarity on what's going on there and what's at stake.
Sure. I mean, this case is about whether or not Trump, as in the executive branch, can potentially withhold federal funds to states or localities who self-identify as sanctuary cities. And part of the litigation centers around sort of who has that authority in the federal government. As I mentioned earlier in the show, certainly Congress can create federal legislation that limits where federal dollars can be spent. But that's the congressional branch of government. This is the executive branch doing this. So part of the litigation is about the separation of powers. The other issue is sort of, you know, anti-commandeering of states, in which federal is not allowed to commandeer states into doing things that step on their sovereignty as states. And so in this particular litigation, the court basically, the court issued what we call a preliminary injunction, which I refer to as sort of hitting the pause mm-hmm. button on the executive order. So there hasn't been a finding on the legality, the underlying legality of the order.
Let me hold you right there. We need to take one more brief break, but we'll be back with lots more on immigration. It's The Exchange on NHPR.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, the debates surrounding undocumented immigrants. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Aaron, right before the break, I wanted to go back to you and let you finish up your comments.
So the federal court decision that's been issued.
Right. The executive order,
yes.
Trump's executive order.
So basically puts the executive order on pause until it will be decided. But again, I just wanted to also just circle back to the point that Shannon mentioned earlier in the show. And that has to do with how much of the immigration system, not just ICE agents, but the entire immigration system is riddled with discretion. And so the ability for even someone to get refugee status or asylum, as we mentioned earlier in the show.
You can say a little bit about asylum. Yeah. That's a difficult thing to get.
Very difficult thing to get. And it's ultimately a decision that's up to the discretion of an immigration officer or an immigration judge. It's a very narrow form of relief that requires a showing that you've been persecuted or will be persecuted in the future on one of five specific grounds: race, nationality, religion, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So very hard to get, high bar.
Yeah, Emily, and then I'll go back to Shannon.
Yeah, I mean, this is just making me think, and I hate to traffic in rumor, but this with this subject in particular, as a reporter, you're just hearing so many anecdotes and rumors, and it's too hard to prove them all. But basically, I mean, people right now are being asked to people who were sort of able to stay under Obama's priorities were often given these check-ins with ICE. I think it's 6 months. And I've been told, anecdotally, that in New Hampshire, immigration attorneys are seeing Hispanic people go to their check-ins and get detained, and Indonesian people go to their check-ins and go home. And I don't know if this is true or not. I absolutely don't know if this is true or not. But it's just such an example of the kind of discretion. It is completely up to the agents what they want to do, and they don't need any other basis than, you know, not having documents, and they can choose either outcome.
Yeah, and Shannon, are you seeing this kind of unevenness in Massachusetts?
I haven't heard any anecdotes about the unevenness, but you know, we did report on five people who were detained at a regularly scheduled appointment at a USCIS office, at a Citizenship and Immigration Services office in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And you know, they went for their appointment. It's something that had been on their books for a couple of weeks. They were basically starting the process. All five of them were starting the process to become green card holders. So they're they're married to maybe U.S. citizens, or they have a U.S. citizen family member in their immediate family, whether it's a parent or a child. And they were taken into custody and detained, and we've been following up on their individual cases. Now, they all did have prior orders of removal, so meaning, you know, they were in ICE's system as having overstayed, you know, whether it was a visa or what have you, but they were supposed to have left the country at some point or another, and they didn't. Now, none of them had criminal records. You know, ICE confirmed that, you know, a few of them had traffic violations, but none of them had criminal records. And they were all taken into custody and detained. And I know at least two of those five remain detained right now. And it's been over a month at this point.
So these are just, when you say traffic, these are just regular traffic violations? Or are we talking something like, you know, driving under the influence or something more serious like that?
No. Okay. They were traffic violations. They were not driving under the influence or anything of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this was a big departure in the priorities that we're talking about. And so they, and they were not all of Hispanic descent. Actually, one of them that I spoke with in detention while he's, you know, at the Bristol County House of Corrections is of Turkish descent. And he's been here for, over 10 years. And it's anyone's guess at this point. And I imagine that it makes it incredibly difficult for immigration attorneys to counsel their clients because, you know, this one attorney told me whose client had been detained at this appointment where she was, you know, she had showed up. She came out of the shadows, so to speak, and showed up and was, you know, intending on starting the process to become a green card holder. And this her attorney told me, you know, I've been working in this field for 11 years. I've never had anyone detained at a USCIS office, you know, undergoing this process. So it's definitely a shift in how things are being done.
Erin, you wanted to jump in?
I just wanted to make, I agree. I've never heard of people being detained at USCIS offices. I think it's important to clarify that people who have final orders of removal, which is what Shannon mentioned all five of these individuals have, means that at some point some claim was lodged for an argument that they should stay in the United States, and that claim was adjudicated by an immigration judge and decided that they didn't have a right to remain here. That doesn't mean that later on they might have other forms of relief that become available to them. But in the past, there has been a priority to remove people who already have final orders of removal.
And yeah, just a couple things I quickly want to mention on this subject. First of all, just a shout out to any listeners who are in this situation. I am actually really trying to find someone, I'm willing to maintain anonymity, who can talk to me about what it's like to try to decide, do I go to my ICE check-in or do I not? I have been looking for this person. I will protect your identity if you're listening. Please get in touch, nhpr.org. Another thing I want to mention is that a consequence of inviting people to regular check-ins to which they are believe that they will, you know, be able to maintain their residence, a consequence of then giving them the fear of detention for checking in, what that does is it can drive people back into the woodwork, into the shadows, and that can have a adverse effect on public safety and a lot of different things. And so that's one thing that we're seeing. I was at a I have a whole anecdote. Do I have time?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was at the Mexican mobile consulate, which came to Manchester last weekend, and this is a place where people of Mexican nationality can come get their passports updated. And there was a woman there who was there with her husband who does not have his papers quite in order. I don't know the exact status, but he needed to get his passport updated for his Mexican passport in order to get his immigration papers straight here. And they almost didn't come, or they considered not coming for fear that ICE would be at the Mexican mobile consulate and pulling people over as they left. And so if they hadn't come, that would mean that he wouldn't get his passport, which would mean he wouldn't get his immigration papers in order, which is very counterproductive, I think, to what people are hoping will happen with undocumented immigrants. And so this is just, you know, a consequence of changing our sort of culture around this.
Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of emails on the topic that we've been discussing today, immigration and undocumented immigrants. Logan from Exeter writes in and gives us sort of the other side of the argument, saying that, you know, we're talking earlier about parents bringing their children here illegally. Logan's reminding us that if the parents are deported, or regardless of the outcome, taxpayers are on the hook for taking care of these children, possibly for decades. Jeff emailed us and points out that he believes most table produce grown in America tends to be harvested by legal and illegal immigrants. He says New Hampshire's apple orchards would be devastated if it wasn't for foreign workers, and says we need a clearer picture of how important these people are to our economy and country. And Erin, let me turn to you here. We have an email from Lawrence who brings up the issue of terminology. And he says the use of the term undocumented it's a propagandist label that would have done George Orwell's 1984 proud. And he says the mainstream commentary should not use blatantly false words as if they had validity. This raises a very sensitive issue of the issue of terminology and whether we use the phrase undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens. Your sense of this issue of terminology?
I mean, I think terminology matters. And I do think some terminology is, I think, intentionally meant to marginalize individuals. And I think some is meant to make some distinctions. I think, generally speaking, the term undocumented it refers to people who come here without papers, which means they cross the border illegally. They don't come with a valid visa or passport. So there's a distinction, and the law actually makes that distinction, and it's a very significant distinction from an immigration law perspective. I think the term illegal, I tend not to use that word Being here without lawful status is a civil infraction. People aren't illegal. They're people. And then I think the other word that we hear that's part of the immigration legislation and code is the word alien. In fact, the Library of Congress has actually no longer uses that term. So the idea of, you know, how do you use a term that describes someone's immigration status in a way that's not offensive, I think is a challenge. I defer to sort of non-citizen, but that, you know, that incorporates everyone and doesn't make distinctions that are sometimes important to make from a legal perspective.
Mm-hmm. Shannon, let me go to Shannon first. Shannon, your sense of how you deal with the issue of terminology.
Well, it's interesting. Aaron just pointed out something that I try to emphasize in reporting, but it's difficult when you're trying to clarify something as complicated as immigration law. But that immigration law is civil in nature, right? So as she said, I mean, you crossing the border illegally, meaning you don't go through a checkpoint or a customs point, it's a hard thing for people to grasp when the word illegal is labeled on someone, and yet the actual legal infraction is civil in nature, right? So it's a hard thing to explain to folks when you have, you know, a 3.5 minute radio story or an online post that you want to be able to be sort of absorbable for everyone. So generally what we sort of try to keep in mind is again, to Aaron's point, you know, these are actual individuals and these are people, and we try to describe sort of the action that they took to get here. So whether in terms of, you know, undocumented versus illegal versus alien, we tend to focus on the someone who's in the country without documentation, or someone who entered the country illegally, is generally how I try to use those terms.
Mm-hmm. Emily, you want to jump in?
Yeah, even just, I mean, as a reporter, you can really, I mean, you can be paralyzed by this problem of choosing the right language because it's very fraught. And in all kinds of subjects, not just issues of immigration, but even the word immigrant itself, I mean, we imbue privilege and sort of different levels of power into words all the time. And when I was reporting this very short story about the mobile Mexican consulate, I suddenly, because I was talking about the Mexican government coming to renew people's passports, for all kinds of people who are Mexican nationals, I suddenly found myself writing the word Mexican expat. And I stopped myself in the middle and I Googled, like, what's the difference between an expat and an immigrant? The only difference is if they're white and American, and, you know, where they're living. Basically, it's a matter of connotation. There's no real difference in that word definitionally. And it just made me think, you know, oh, wow, even the word immigrant is actually, you know, full of subtle power hints and legitimacy issues. And it was a really good reminder to myself that, these words they aren't universal and they're very subjective.
Aaron, I want to ask you a fairly specific question about this issue of churches being sanctuaries. We know, we saw the Catholic Diocese of Manchester recently said that the Catholic churches could not be sanctuaries. In my preparation for the show, I did a lot of reading on churches as sanctuaries, and the term civil disobedience kept popping up, that the idea that essentially these kinds of institutions filling that role is an act of civil disobedience. And I was curious, kind of, what are the legal ramifications of a church or some other institution, you know, not necessarily a city or a town, but a specific institution saying that we are a sanctuary?
I mean, I think it's complicated. I mean, this term of sort of sanctuary and the role that the church has played in sort of becoming a safe haven for mm-hmm. those who are being subject to the whims of an arbitrary action by the government, you know, has roots back into the Middle Ages.
Sure.
Right? So this idea that God's law is above man-made law, or and that churches have a moral obligation to do what God says, not what the government says. And I think that's the distinction, and sort of how does that play out in a democracy where we value free speech, where we value civil disobedience, and we also think that there should be a separation between church and state, and that also laws shouldn't impinge on the ability of churches to exercise.
But in theory, if somebody seeks sanctuary in a church, the federal government, the ICE could come in and just take the person out of the church?
Right. I mean, churches, I mean, unlike the
Vatican,
there's
no legal protection.
Unlike the Vatican, are not themselves their own form of government. I think historically law enforcement has not done that for a variety of different reasons, some of which undoubtedly are political. But the church is part of – they're not above the law in any sense any more than anyone else is. From a legal perspective.
Mm-hmm. And Shannon, let me ask you, in the time we have remaining, where do you see the whole debate moving, or the movement itself going in Massachusetts and your part of New England? What are you going to be watching?
Sure.
What are you going to be looking for in the coming
months?
There are several
things actually on, coming up. And one is a really potentially influential case coming out of the Supreme Judicial Court here in Massachusetts. It's called Commonwealth versus Lunn. And essentially, the decision at hand is, do local law enforcement in Massachusetts even have the legal authority to cooperate with ICE, with federal immigration officials, when it comes to something called ICE detainers, which essentially is a request by ICE officials to hold someone who otherwise would be free to go after, say, they posted bond, or their charges were dropped, or they served their time for whatever the infraction may have been, and ICE says, wait a second, can you hold that person for, a couple of days while we sort of explore their background and whether or not we want to pursue deportation proceedings with them, and that has a really big potential influence here in Massachusetts, because and nationwide, because there are other questions at hand in the court system throughout the country as to the sort of amount of authority local law enforcement has to cooperate at the federal level. And there's a few bills. There's a few bills at Beacon Hill that we're following as well.
Emily, real quick, we're almost out of time, but the New England News Collaborative, you're going to continue to cover this story as well?
We're hoping to be able to try to quantify the resources that are going to be required in terms of judges, in terms of ICE officers, just to process all of the increased detentions and deportations.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are out of time. I'd like to thank all of my guests. Erin Corcoran of UNH Law, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Emily Corwin, New Hampshire Public Radio, and the New England News Collaborative, we appreciate you being here as well.
Thanks.
And Shannon Dooling of WBUR Boston and the New England News Collaborative, we really appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips are our producers. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.